If your libido's in the toilet, sex hurts like hell, and an orgasm is out of the question, I've got your back. Come Again, Sexuality and Orgasm is my solution-driven limited series podcast to get your libido to kick in and your clitoral nerve endings to wake up. You can find Come Again on drstriker.substack.com. Do cell phones cause brain cancer? Does using an antiperspirant increase the risk of breast cancer? Does fluoride in the water increase the risk of bone cancer? Is the HPV vaccine life-saving or dangerous? And what will be the impact of the so-called Make America Healthy Again movement, specifically on cancer? I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. Dr. Shika Jain is a board-certified hematologist-oncologist, an associate professor at the University of Illinois Cancer Center in Chicago, and has too many honors and publications to name. She's also an incredible communicator and is out there in the world, educating, dispelling myths, and demystifying cancer care. She's passionate about gender equity and social constructs that impact marginalized communities. She does good work. And we have a lot in common. Dr. Jain and I both live in Chicago. We frequently appear on panels together. We share a passion for educating by sticking to the science. And we're both concerned about the future of healthcare. And fun fact, one of Dr. Jain's mentors is my ex-husband. So we also have him in common. Welcome, Dr. Jain.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be having this super important conversation with you.
You know, and thank you for doing this. We were on a panel together a couple of days ago, and during the break, I roped you into taping this last minute since my scheduled guest had to cancel. All right, today is all about sticking to the science and sticking to facts. So here's the plan. First, I'm going to have you dispel some common myths about cancer. And then, fair warning, we're going to be talking politics. There are a lot of people who say stick to medicine, but today, politicians, not scientists, determine how doctors practice medicine. So politics is medicine. And I want to know from an oncologist's point of view how recent political policies and actions are going to impact the risk of getting cancer, the availability of cancer treatment, and cancer research. But first, let's just bust some myths. So take it away. Start with the top three myths that you hear about cancer, and not specific types of cancer, just cancer in general.
So first of all, I'm so glad we're talking about this because misinformation is rampant. It is everywhere, and social media has allowed it to travel much faster than in the past. So the three most common myths that I've been hearing, especially recently, number one, that cancer is fed by sugar. That is not a fact. We do not see sugar feeding cancer. If you have cancer, you can eat sugar. If you have diabetes, be a little bit careful with how much sugar you eat, but sugar does not feed cancer. A second very common one that's been spreading around recently is that mammograms cause cancer. That is not a fact either. Mammograms do not cause cancer. Mammograms actually can catch cancer, meaning you can detect a cancer early stage using screening mammograms. So mammograms absolutely do not cause cancer. And the third myth that I hear very, very often is that when you get a biopsy, biopsies can actually spread cancer. And I will tell you that there are one or two types of cancer where that can happen, but that is very uncommon. And the majority of cancers, a biopsy or surgery will not spread the cancer. So those are three of the most common myths that I hear.
Yeah. And, you know, to your point, when we talk about mammograms do not increase cancer, but we also have right now the highest cure rate we've had really for cancer ever, for breast cancer. And why? Because we're catching it earlier when it's more treatable. So we're finding more of it, but because it's so early, we can actually cure it.
Exactly. And that's the thing that people ask all the time. Well, why are cancer rates going up? Is it because we're getting exposed to this radiation during imaging? No, the fact that we are seeing an increase in cancer comes from a variety of topics. It comes from the foods we're eating. It comes from the climate change issues that we're seeing. It comes from the fact that we also are doing such great screening that we're catching more cancers these days on imaging early stage. So there's a lot of reasons why we're seeing an increase in cancer, but things like mammograms are not the cause of that.
Yeah. There's also this idea that you can potentially catch cancer by someone who has it. And I think, you know, it's a blanket statement. We could say, no, cancer isn't contagious. But it gets a little sticky because we know that there are certain viruses that cause cancer. So as an example, HPV causes cervical cancer. So if you have sex with someone who has cervical cancer, can you catch it? Or colon cancer, which is associated with H. pylori. You know, if you're with someone who has colon cancer, can you catch that? Hepatitis, liver cancer. So you see where I'm going here. You know, we know that viruses can cause cancer. So can you catch cancer by getting their virus that caused the cancer?
So that's a great question. And the biggest thing I think that's most important is a point that you made. So HPV is a virus. HPV can cause, certain strains of HPV can cause cervical cancer. First of all strains of HPV cannot cause cervical cancer. Second of all, we have a vaccine that can prevent you from developing cervical cancer by preventing you from getting HPV. So when you talk about, can you catch cancer from someone? No, cancer is not contagious. However, viruses like HPV are contagious. So you could catch, so to speak, I'm putting in air quotes here, you could catch HPV from someone else, meaning they could transmit the virus to you during sexual activity, and then that could eventually cause a cervical cancer. But that's not meaning that you are catching cancer from somebody who has cancer. It's the virus that causes the cancer that you've caught. And if you get vaccinated, you can prevent that.
And we're going to return to vaccines a little later. You know, years ago when I was in practice, I had this horrible dilemma because I had a patient who had an HPV cervical cancer. And then she divorced her husband. And then her husband, who obviously had HPV, was dating another one of my patients. And I couldn't tell her, of course. But I just encouraged her to, that was a tricky one. People don't think about those kinds of ethical dilemmas that all doctors find themselves in, but particularly gynecologists, just saying. So we're going to do, on to something else. We're going to do a lightning round here. And I'm just going to ask you real quick some of the myths, and I want you to give me a yes, that's true, no, it's not, or we don't know, and feel free to embellish if you want. You already hit my first two, which was consuming sugar feed cancer cells, and it does not. Mammograms, we covered that. How about living near a power line?
No.
No. All right. Cell phones and brain cancer?
No. No data as of yet.
All right. What about the whole using deodorant and antiperspirants and increasing the risk of breast cancer?
So there's really no strong scientific evidence yet. The American Cancer Society has not made that connection yet. I don't think there's strong enough evidence to say that deodorants or antiperspirants cause cancer.
Yeah. Microplastics. You know, I've been talking about microplastics a lot because they're everywhere in our food and in gum and in products and in the air. And it's always kind of nonspecific why microplastics are bad. Is there any data that suggests that microplastics can cause cancer?
So the data here is a little bit fuzzy. There isn't definitive data right now that microplastics in our food cause cancer. I will be interested to see how we learn more about this down the line. There have been some potential links that have been proposed between microplastics and breast cancer. There have been some very early studies that have looked into it and said there may be a causal link. But again, we need more information. And we're starting to see more and more of these microplastics now. Remember, Dr. Stryker, as you know, when we talk about science, it takes years sometimes to get the evidence and the data. And microplastics are relatively new finding in our bodies, in our drinking water. So I think we will learn more. But right now, there is no really definitive link that links microplastics in our food to cancers.
Yeah. And with microplastics, it's really difficult because there's no way that you can eliminate microplastics completely because they truly are everywhere, which brings me to the next thing, which is the whole idea of plastic wrap and microwaving in plastic containers. Is there any evidence that that is linked to cancer?
Not as of now. What I would say is make sure you're using microwave safe containers to the best of your ability. There is currently no data that links plastic wrap or microwaving in plastic containers and a link to cancer.
Yeah. I switched to glass. It's also better for the environment, right?
Yeah. And I will tell you, I've got three kids. And so we've been using more and more glass and metal recently, just again, because it's good for the environment. But yeah, there's no link that we know of directly to cancer as of now.
We're going to spend a few minutes on estrogen, because it's one thing for me to say estrogen doesn't increase the risk of getting cancer, but it's another thing to hear it from an oncologist. So I'm going to list a bunch of stuff with estrogen, and I want to hear your take. Increase the risk, decrease the risk, no change in risk, or we just don't know. So let's start with birth control pills, which are the highest amount of estrogen that we can give someone in the form of medication.
So birth control pills, as we know, I don't know if you know this, I wrote a paper about how they have a PR problem because they're not just birth control. They're also used for PCOS. They're also used for people who have acne. So I don't like calling them birth control pills.
I don't either. I call them hormone regulating pills.
There you go. I love it. I love that. So birth control pills are interesting because, like you said, it's got the highest level of estrogen. Now, in patients or people who have a risk or a genetic predisposing factor to developing an estrogen-positive breast cancer, for example, if they have a family history, if they've had a history of a breast cancer themselves that is fed by estrogen or is one of those that have ER or PR positive, those people, we tell them to be a little bit more cautious. We don't recommend estrogen-type birth control pills.
All right. Well, I'm gonna challenge you on that a little bit. Because the patients that I saw a huge number of were the women who had a genetic mutation, such as a BRCA, a BRCA mutation, which of course increases the risk of both breast cancer and ovarian cancer. And we actually have a fair amount of data of women with a BRCA mutation taking birth control pills, which is quite frankly going to dramatically reduce their risk of ovarian cancer. We know that, and doesn't seem to have an impact on their risk of breast cancer. And like you said, these are the women that are at highest risk. When you look at all of the risk factors for breast cancer, genetic mutations are at the top of the list. So what's your take on birth control pills, particularly in that population?
I agree with you 100% because, as you said, birth control does help with preventing ovarian cancer. So it's really an informed decision with you and your doctor. But the biggest thing that I say is if you have a history, if you yourself have a personal history of a breast cancer that had estrogen receptor positivity or progesterone receptor positivity, then we become a bit more cautious on prescribing those types of birth control pills. But again, a family history, genetic predisposing conditions are not an absolute to not receive birth control. I would say I would recommend it for many of them because, as you said, they might be at higher risk for ovarian cancer as well. So again, it's not an absolute. This is it's very nuanced, and it's become more and more difficult to discuss because, as we discussed on our panel, when the Women's Health Initiative reports came out earlier, there was a lot of misinformation out there about estrogen and how it feeds different types of cancers. And I think that it's important to note that, as you mentioned, these birth control pills can be very helpful for some of those patients.
Yeah. And there's a big difference between data, because you and I are both data-driven, versus the absence of data. You know, sometimes we just say no one has studied that for whatever reason. All right, so let's move on to more of the perimenopause and postmenopause woman who's using a local vaginal estrogen. Does using a local vaginal estrogen for, say, 30, 40, 50 years, does that increase the risk of getting breast cancer?
No. And I'll tell you why I say it so confidently. Because when you are using vaginal estrogen, when we talk about estrogen that's at risk for someone, we're talking about systemic absorption, which that means is when you're taking it orally, when it gets into the bloodstream. Vaginal estrogen, you're using small amounts, you're using them in the vaginal area, you're using it as a cream or a lotion. You know more about this than I do because this is your area of expertise. But the chance of getting systemic absorption from using vaginal estrogen is very, 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 very low. And the benefits of using local vaginal estrogen are very, very high. So the risk, I would say, is very minimal. And I don't think that there is a significant concern if you're going to use vaginal estrogen for multiple years.
All right. So let's switch that to a person who's living with a breast cancer diagnosis, either recent or remote. Does using a local vaginal estrogen change their prognosis or increase the risk of a recurrence?
So again, it goes back to systemic absorption. if you're using a local vaginal estrogen, it's local, it's just in the vaginal area, you're not absorbing it systemically. So again, it's a discussion with what you are comfortable with and what you and your physician are comfortable with. But for the most part, using a local vaginal estrogen should not significantly, if at all, increase your risk of developing recurrence from using the using the local vaginal estrogen.
So, okay, I just want to point out that I have been saying this like 100 times a day, like a broken record, but now you have heard it from an oncologist, from a cancer doctor, that using your local vaginal estrogen is not going to give you cancer. And if you have cancer, it is not in any way going to change your prognosis. And we have excellent data that supports that, in addition to the fact that, like Dr. Jane says, there's really no significant systemic levels, and we know that. So now we're going to get a little trickier. Does taking systemic estrogen increase the risk of breast cancer? And I'm specifically asking about estrogen. We're taking progesterone and synthetic progestogens off the table. A woman who is just taking systemic estrogen, for example, someone who's had a hysterectomy, is that going to increase her risk of getting breast cancer?
So what I would say is, to be most accurate, the most accurate way to say this would be estrogen can contribute to breast cancer development rather than directly causing it. So what that means is, if you already have cancer cells, then estrogen can facilitate the growth of cancer cells once they've already been established. So I would not say that systemic estrogen would cause breast cancer, but if you already have estrogen sensitive cells, cancer cells in your body, it can cause the development of a breast cancer. Does that make sense?
Yes. So going back to the Women's Health Initiative, the WHI, in that study, women who took systemic estrogen alone had a 21% decreased risk of breast cancer. And if they did develop breast cancer, they had a 40% decreased risk of dying. So based on that data, would you say that using estrogen alone is actually protective to the breasts and may reduce risk?
Yes.
Okay. So the other thing, good. I'm so glad we're in agreement with that, because I talk about that all the time too. But I think, to your point, when people say, okay, well, why in the WHI do we see this increase? Well, there were two reasons. One, there was the synthetic progesterone aspect, which we're not going to get into today. But the other thing, to your point, is that if someone already has cancer cells, theoretically, estrogen can be fertilizer to those cells that can make them grow. And in the WHI, that study was cut off at 5 years. So Dr. Jane, when we see a lump or cancer is diagnosed on a mammogram, when did that cancer start?
Your guess is as good as mine. It's impossible to really know when a cancer starts. Sometimes people have very slow growing cancers that could be there for a very long time. Some cancers are more aggressive and they can grow very quickly. So it's impossible to know when the cancer actually started.
Yeah. And I think to that point, a lot of people hypothesize that the reason that there was that uptick in the WHI in breast cancer is that women who had an undetected, undiagnosed breast cancer then started taking estrogen. And not only may it have facilitated the growth, but these women were being really closely watched. They were getting their regular mammograms. They were getting exams. So it wasn't that the estrogen caused the breast cancer. It's that they already had it. And the way the study was designed ensured that it was found, which is, I think, actually one of the reasons why they did better. You know, there was a 40% decrease in death because these women found their cancers earlier, which brings us back to our original get your mammograms. All right, last question on estrogen, and then I'll take you off the hook on this one. As an oncologist, is it ever okay for a woman with a breast cancer diagnosis to use systemic estrogen?
So to answer that, we need to make the point that all breast cancers are not the same. There are breast cancers that are hormone receptor positive. We often hear them called ER or PR positive. There's breast cancers that are called triple negative, where they're hormone receptor negative and they're HER2 negative. There are some that are just hormone receptor positive. So I say that because I want to emphasize the point that if you are a patient who has a breast cancer diagnosis that is hormone receptor positive, then it's not typically recommended for you to take systemic estrogen. However, if you are a patient who has breast cancer that was triple negative or does not have hormone receptor positivity, then there may be ability for you to take systemic estrogen because your type of breast cancer that your body has is the type that does not is not fed, so to speak, by hormones.
Which brings us back to the nuances of personalized medicine. The other thing I think it's important to point out is that a lot of these recommendations are not based on data, you know, giving women estrogen and then they do poorly. It's we don't have the data. It's the absence of data. And everybody is understandably reluctant to give women estrogen who have a breast cancer diagnosis. So while we do have some emerging data, and certainly in some circumstances it is appropriate, it's nuanced shared decision making like everything else, right?
Well, and I want to add, it's not just in estrogen therapy that we don't have data. We talk about this extensively where women weren't included in NIH-funded trials until the 90s. There is so much missing data for women in all aspects of women's health that this is just one really great example of we don't have the information. So we can't always, the information that we're using didn't include women in many cases. So exactly. When it comes to this type of information, we need more research, we need more science, we need more data to support what we're doing.
We need more data.
Yep.
All right. So this panel that we were on the other day was on the topic of research, in women's health, what the limitations are, what the challenges are, and what we can expect going forward. And one of the things that came up was a question from the audience was, okay, well, why don't we just kind of ride the wave of what's happening politically and see what happens? And your response was perfect. You said, no, we can't ride the waves because there are sharks in those waves. So we're going to talk about some of those sharks, specifically cancer-causing sharks. Let's start with two big sharks, the biggest sharks, I think, obesity and processed foods. And it is known that obesity is associated with 13 different types of cancer, colon, rectal, breast and postmenopausal breast, uterus, esophagus, gallbladder, liver, kidney, ovaries, pancreas, thyroid, meningiomas, and multiple myeloma. And we know that processed food is specifically associated with an increased risk of colorectal cancer, breast, prostate, pancreatic, and ovarian cancer, and probably a few I haven't listed. So as we look into what the new administration is suggesting, and I want to be real clear that this is not meant to be partisan. We are just sticking to the science here. We are sticking to the facts. We are looking at these policies that are being put into place. And one of the things is this understanding that our diet is killing us. And I think we would agree with that. So is this new? Should we all be breathing a huge sigh of relief that we now have RFK who's going to address obesity and processed food?
So you're absolutely right. I am very concerned with what's going on currently in the state of affairs when it comes to science and when it comes to what's happening with healthcare. This is not new. Former First Lady Michelle Obama had an entire Get Moving, Get Healthy initiative that she launched when President Obama was in office. Former Surgeon General Vivek Murthy has talked about the necessity of healthy eating and the challenge that processed foods and all of these things cause when it comes to our overall health. So none of these things are new. Just because the current administration is saying we need to get rid of dyes, we need to make sure people are healthy, this whole idea that doctors are not interested in having patients be healthy is a farce. In my opinion, data has shown over the years that doctors care a great deal about healthy eating. We talk about the fact that exercise during treatments for cancer actually improve your overall outcome and prognosis if you have a diagnosis of cancer. So what we're talking about now is not new. This has been talked about, it's been written about, it's been published on for years. So this is not a new concept that we're trying to quote unquote make America healthy again because we haven't thought about these things in the past, you know, decades. What is happening now is the way they are framing it. They're making it seem like these concepts are brand new and no one has talked about them, when in actuality, we have been talking about this and we've been advocating for it and we've been publishing science on it for years.
But why has it not happened? I think that's really the big question. If in fact, and I agree with you that this is nothing new about this, that there are plenty of people who've been concerned about this for a very long time, yet we continue to have a diet that's primarily processed foods. The number of folks with obesity continues to go up. Cancer rates are skyrocketing, particularly in young people. Why have we failed in the past? Do you think that these new policies are going to have an impact? And then I'll ask you the really hard question is, if you were in charge of this whole thing, what would you do?
Well, it's an easy answer as to why, this is becoming an even bigger and bigger problem. One, healthy foods are expensive. Processed foods are cheap. It is way cheaper to go to McDonald's and buy a Happy Meal than it is to go to a grocery store and buy fresh fruits and vegetables. It is, when we talk about how we are feeding our country, the way that we are providing opportunities for people, especially people who may not have very high ability to get to a Whole Foods or get to a place where they're organic, you know, foods, fruits and vegetables, or even just fresh fruits and vegetables at the grocery store. People are thinking, can I pay for my medication or can I pay for my children's lunch tomorrow at school? So one really big aspect is the cost of food, and the cost of the unhealthier options are usually much lower than the healthier options. So that's one. Number two, you've got to think about where the money is. We've talked about this quite a bit. A lot of the people who are hawking these, you know, nutritional supplements or these, you know, get thin, quick schemes. And, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow's out there with her lifestyle brand talking about all of the things that are going to make you healthy. A lot of those things are not based in science. A lot of those things are based on good marketing and good publicity. And just because someone says this magic pill is going to cure your cancer does not mean it's going to cure your cancer. But the money is in the marketing for these types of things, okay, that, and people believe it. And so I think we need to not just think about how are we going to fix the problem. We also need to think about, one, how are we going to make healthy eating and less processed foods more affordable? Two, I think education is a huge component. I work in the University of Illinois, where we have a very large population of patients who come from areas where they don't have access to healthy foods and vegetables or healthy choices. So I think we need to talk about education. We need to talk about improving the cost. And we need to have more regulation on people who are selling these, you know, get healthy quick schemes that are really just lining their pockets and not actually helping our population.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I really think where this needs to start is in the schools, because if we can provide healthy school lunches to kids who live in food deserts, whose parents can't afford to go to the grocery store, we're going to have an enormous impact, not only on childhood obesity, but also educating them as to what is healthy food, what is good food. Unfortunately, the people that provided those healthy breakfasts and lunch were through the Federal Department of Education, which has now been defunded. I think a lot of people are not aware of that, that that was one of the largest roles of the Department of Education, is to ensure healthy food for these kids. And so that is going to be a huge challenge in going forward. So I think when we look at processed food and having obesity, we are in agreement that this is an enormous problem, not just in general health, but cancer specifically, and that so far I have not seen anything in this current plan that is going to help with that, quite frankly. So I hate to be the pessimist there, but it is a little frightening.
I want to emphasize one thing as well, which I said on the panel, which I think is really important. Just because I come up on stage or come up on a national platform and say, I'm going to cure cancer, or I'm going to get rid of all food dyes, or I'm going to make this massive change, it's not as simple as just saying, I'm going to do this. To make a statement like that and then not have an actual plan to implement, that is not a solution. That is what we've been dealing with a lot of these wellness influencers, which they come on and they say, I'm going to do this for you. And there's no actually strategy or plan in place to make it happen. And that is my biggest concern. So you asked, is the current administration going to fix the problem? I would love to be optimistic and say, yes, they will. Unfortunately, none of us have seen an actual plan with actual strategies to fix the problem. And until we start seeing how the problem is going to get fixed, that's different from what's been done in the last several decades, I am not optimistic that we're going to see a solution, because just talking about it is not a solution.
Yeah, it's not enough to say, don't eat processed foods and don't be overweight.
Exactly.
It doesn't work like that.
Right.
Okay, moving on. It's not just the measles vaccine that RFK opposes. It's all vaccines. And the vaccine that has had the absolute biggest impact on cancer is the HPV vaccine, which we mentioned earlier. I mean, the HPV vaccine is a huge success story because it prevents not only cervical cancer, but other cancers associated with HPV, such as vulvar, cervical, anal, penile, and oral cancers like cancer of the mouth, tongue, and throat. And I mean, honestly, the fact that we have a vaccine that prevents cancer is, from my point of view, one of the biggest advances in medicine and cancer in the last century. Yet, and again, just stating fact here, RFK has publicly stated multiple times that the HPV is, quote, dangerous and defective, and that, quote, no loving parent would allow their child to receive it. He has suggested that the vaccine's ingredients increase the risk of cancer, lead to autoimmune conditions, and may be responsible for a rise in mental illness. And he's actively lobbied against state efforts to mandate HPV vaccines for school children. So I'm going to stop talking. You take it from there.
So I will tell you, I have gotten the HPV vaccine. I have three children. As soon as they are old enough to get the HPV vaccine, they are all going to get it. If we had a vaccine to prevent colon cancer or lung cancer, people would be lining up to get it. The fact that we have a vaccine that can literally prevent cancer, that is very safe, that has been tested, that has been scientifically proven to prevent cancer, everyone should be lining up to get it when they are eligible. Everyone should be having their children get it as soon as they're eligible.
And I want to be clear, when you talk children, we're talking boys too, not just girls.
Absolutely. So I have three kids, a daughter and two sons. All three of them will be getting it. Because remember what we said earlier, you can catch HPV from a sexual partner. So when you have HPV, it is transmissible and that can cause cancer. I want to emphasize this point because I think this gets lost a lot in this day and age with the rise of the social media expert. I am a triple board certified internal medicine, hematology, and oncology physician. I went to school 4 years. I studied, I learned, I know the science, I know the data, I know the evidence, I know the risks and benefits. I would never put something into my children that would be dangerous. I do this knowing the science and being a very loving mother. I would stand in front of a bus for my children. I would do anything to protect them. And to know that there is a vaccine that could prevent them from potentially ever getting a cancer is a no-brainer to me. The fact that we have such a large anti-vaccine population and rhetoric in this country is baffling to me because the science is there. The science backs the HPV vaccine along with many of these other vaccines that are being lobbied against, the measles vaccine, the flu vaccine. These have been around for a long, long time. And we know that they are safe, they are effective. And in this case, they can actually save lives by preventing cancer.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's bad enough for someone to come out and say it's dangerous and defective, which is not true. But the rhetoric that really, really kills me is that no loving parent would allow their child to receive it. So kind of really playing on the emotion of it, and a parent starts to question what they have been told by their pediatrician, by their doctors, because we're talking about young kids. I mean, the ideal time, a lot of people don't realize this. A lot of times I say, well, I'll wait till they're older. The ideal time for someone to get the HPV vaccine is before puberty, when they're young, for two reasons. One is that they're unlikely to have been exposed to HPV. And the second is they get the best immunologic response. We know the younger someone is, the more robust their immune system is going to be in terms of protecting them, correct?
Absolutely. And I want to also make this point to show how powerful this anti-vaccine lobby is. So my daughter is almost 11. When I went to her very first pediatrician appointment, I was sleep deprived. I was a new mom. I was exhausted. And the first time she went for her vaccines, for a brief second, I thought, maybe all these anti-vaccine people are correct. My daughter's getting all these vaccines. Maybe these are dangerous. That is how powerful this anti-vaccine lobby is. It seeps into the subconscious of even the most intelligent, well-read, knowledgeable people. But luckily for me, I know the data. So within 5 seconds, I was like, that's just the nonsense that is spreading on social media. It is safe. And all of my children are fully vaccinated. They are all doing very well. And I will continue to vaccinate them for any vaccine that they are eligible for.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think that's such a good point because every parent has self-doubt about everything.
Yes.
You know, when my oldest was a baby and my mother came over and said, "What do you mean you're not sterilizing her baby bottles?" And I'm thinking, oh, I thought it was just okay to put them in the dishwasher. And then I started to doubt myself, even though I knew that was okay. So we all do it. That's human nature. But I think, you know, the obvious counter to that is people are saying, well, why would RFK and others like him say that? What's in it for them?
And that's where you need to follow the money. So one, a lot of people who are going out and saying vaccines are not good for you often have a hidden motive. We don't always know what their hidden motive is. Sometimes the hidden motive is they sell their own health supplements that they say are better than vaccines. Some of them have really been inundated with this misinformation for so long, they actually believe it. I have a lot of patients who come to me and say, "Dr. Jane, I've done my own research." I 100% love when my patients come in and say, "I've done my own research," because then we review the data. We talk about the science. We talk about what's true and what's false. The problem is a lot of these people who are spouting this anti-vaccine information, the data they're spouting is not fact. It's a lot of opinion and it's their opinion, but they don't have the science or the data to back up what they're saying. So you have to follow the money and you have to figure out why. Why are they spouting this? What is the benefit to them? And for some of them, it's political clout. For some people, it's they need to get reelected and they know the people in their districts believe the anti-vaccine rhetoric. For some people, it really is a financial benefit. For some people, they actually truly believe this because they have read whatever articles they've read that they believe are fact. But my favorite thing that I tell my children and I tell to adults now too, just because you have an opinion on something does not make it a fact. Facts are facts based on science, data, and evidence. Me saying I'm the Queen of England does not make me the Queen of England. Me saying vaccines work, I'm not saying that just because it's my opinion. I'm saying it because it is backed by science, data, and hundreds of thousands of clinical trials that have looked into these things. And that is how we do science. That's why we aren't all dying at the age of 30 like people were back in, you know, the 20s and 30s.
Right. And, you know, a lot of times when they say, "Oh, well, we don't have a placebo trial for a vaccine." Well, first of all, the nature of that kind of research is not the standard, you know, 1,000 people get it and 1,000 people don't. That would be irresponsible to do something with the measles vaccine. And the example I give is that if someone designed a new parachute, you wouldn't put two people in the plane and have one person jump out without the parachute and the other person jump out with the parachute to prove that the parachute works, because we know that it will not end well for the person without the parachute. So to the exactly. same, you know, for the well, same I reason, you're not going to give half the people a measles vaccine and half not, particularly when we already have the science that supports it.
Exactly. I work with clinical trials every day. I'm the primary investigator on a lot of cancer clinical trials. So imagine you're diagnosed with cancer and you go to the doctor and they say, "Great, we have a clinical trial for you. You can either get treated or you're not going to get treated. And we're going to see who does better." That is essentially what these placebo trials are. You have cancer, you're going to be randomized, you're going to be put in an arm where you don't get treated, or you're going to get treatment for cancer. Yeah. That's why placebo trials have not been the standard of care for years, because one, they're not ethical when it comes to people's lives. You can't have a placebo-controlled trial and say half of the people are going to develop a disease or die because we're not going to treat them to prove that this treatment works.
Well, and just to be clear, so people know how it is done, is generally half the people will get the standard treatment for cancer, and then the other people will get maybe the new drug or the new protocol. So it's not that they're not comparing, they're just not saying you don't get anything at all.
Exactly. And we're fortunate in the day and age we're in now where we have so many incredible treatments and interventions that we have things to compare to. So we can say we've treated patients in this way for this many years. Let's see if our newer innovation, our newer medication, our newer technology does a better job or it does a similar job to what we had previously. Yeah. And so that's the key. We can't be doing placebo-controlled trials in vaccines, because at the end of the day, I wouldn't want my kid not getting a vaccine and potentially dying from a preventable, treatable illness.
Right. And specifically with HPV vaccines, the first HPV vaccine only covered 4 strains of HPV. The current vaccine covers 9 strains of HPV, which essentially is all of the dangerous strains. And they were tested against each other to see which strains were covered. So there's firm, robust science behind all of this. On to fluoride. Another. All right. We know it is not controversial that putting a small amount of fluoride in our water supply has prevented millions of cavities, saved tens of billions of dollars in dental costs, and made kids and adults healthier. And as an example, if you want a placebo-controlled trial, fluoride is not used in Hawaii, has not been used in Hawaii, and they have the highest rate of tooth decay among children in the nation and some of the worst oral health in adults of any state. Yet, the current administration wants to take fluoride out of water, and one of the specific reasons that is given is that it will increase the risk of cancer, specifically bone cancer. What's the science behind that?
So I'm going to tell you first, I always like to start with a fact. Fluoride does not cause bone cancer. There is no evidence in any sort of scientific proof that fluoride causes bone cancer. There's no definitive link, especially in the levels that we see at the dentist or in our drinking water. The study that they reference is a study that was done in 1990, done on male rats. And what they found was that there was a slight increase in bone cancer in male rats exposed to very, very high doses of fluoride. But there were other studies that were done in follow-up, because anytime we have a study, we always need to see it replicated to make sure it wasn't an anomaly. The studies that were done after that did not replicate that result. So what that means is one study showed this, follow-up studies did not show this data. So there is no evidence to conclude that there is a credible link between fluoride and bone cancer. And this one study, again, was done on rats, male rats, and it was not replicated in other trials. So what that means is that the amount of fluoride that is in our drinking water is safe. It has, as you said, it's done great things for dental health. It's done great things to prevent tooth decay. And there is no reason that we should be removing fluoride from all of our water, because it has positive public health benefits.
Yeah. And I think what's probably going to happen is that there will be water that's fortified with fluoride that you can purchase. But let's be honest, the people who are able to purchase it are not the ones who are at the highest risk for having dental problems. You know, the people who go to the dentist regularly and see their dental hygienist regularly are the people that are also going to be using the fluoridated toothpastes and water. And it's this very at-risk population, which does not get that kind of care, that is also not going to be getting fluoride. So
exactly. What we're doing is as we talked about earlier, we're leaving out our populations of people who don't have access to the privilege that the people who are making decisions have access to. And I think it goes to the fact that the decisions that are being made thinking about a certain echelon of this population, and those people who don't have access to the things that the people with a lot of money who are making the decisions have access to is very clear in the decisions that are being made.
Let's switch gears a little bit. One of the things that we were discussing on this panel that we were on a couple of days ago was really specifically looking at research in women, research in menopause, and research in cancer, which is how we both ended up on this panel. I was the menopause part. We're not going to talk about that today. And you were looking specifically at cancer research in women. So tell me what's going on in cancer research in women now, and what are your concerns going forward?
So my concerns, and this is actually applicable to everyone, it's not even just women. We are seeing cancer funding being pulled across the country. We are seeing millions of dollars of cancer funding being pulled. And a lot of people don't understand that this money that is being pulled is directly funding clinical trials. It's directly funding the researchers and the scientists who are doing this groundbreaking work. This is not a slush fund of extra money that's just sitting around, that's being used for hats and fancy things for people to buy, or, you know, Birkin bags. That's, I had somebody actually say to me, oh, well, that just means that these researchers, you know, they're just not going to, their salaries aren't going to be as high. What people don't understand is we are literally seeing the money for clinical trials removed. Trials are being shut down. They're being put on hold. People who have submitted grants for research that they worked years on is just being stopped, meaning research labs are being shut down. People are losing their jobs. And people who rely on these clinical trials for their cancer care are going to lose their ability to get their treatments if we continue to see this money being pulled. We are seeing a huge, huge drain on our funding for advancement and innovation, not just in cancer, in diabetes, in heart health, in women's health. Across the board, we're seeing money be pulled, and we are about to see a very, well, we're already seeing a very scary time for scientific advancement in this country.
I think people don't realize the impact of an NIH grant, because these NIH grants are not just doing esoteric, you know, little minimally interesting trials. They are really funding everything. New drug trials, clinical trials, as you said, looking for new cancer treatments. But the other thing that is also happening isn't just the defunding of the NIH and all those trials, but it's what's going on in universities. Because when you start defunding research in universities, which very often also have an NIH component, you are shutting down complete labs, which means that not only are you losing research, but you are also losing education of young scientists. And we are losing our most experienced scientists and researchers. We're hearing more and more about the brain drain, that all of these scientists that have lost their jobs and have lost their funding, they have families to feed. They have to, you know, pay rent. So what's happening? They are being recruited all over the country. And I was at an event a few days ago that was about research specifically. And there were some researchers from Israel there who are doing incredible research. And I said, are you recruiting from the United States? And they said, you bet, but it's not so easy right now because so is every other country. And this is huge, because even if there were to be some reversal and they were to say, oh, gee, we were maybe shouldn't have taken that sledgehammer and gotten rid of all of this funding and all of this cancer research, let's restart it again. Those people are gone. They are gone. They are being recruited to other countries. And like you said, it's not, someone said to me at this event when we were talking about it, she goes, well, they're just cutting down on the waste, you know, so they don't get free lunches and so they don't have too much staff. I'm like, no. They were already operating really, really lean. I mean, one of the things we talk about how long research takes, and one of the reasons it takes so long, other than the nature of research, is there was this constant need to find funding, to apply for the next grant, to find graduate students who wanted to work in that lab. So we have a big issue, not only on what's going on now, but just even looking at the next 10, 20 years. People say, okay, we just got to get through the next 4 years. It's not that simple.
Right. Well, and the point that you made, I think, is so important, that research is not something that happens in 24 hours, 48 hours, a month. This is years of work. And so people are absolutely leaving because they want to continue their work. And these are people who have dedicated their lives to advancing science, to advancing health. These are people who care about actually making America healthy. They are really dedicated to this type of science, and they are our brightest, our smartest, and they are leaving. And they're leaving because their funding is being pulled, because they're getting fired, because their lab has shut down. And when we talk about America being one of the most innovative, highest advanced when it comes to science, when it comes to medicine, when it comes to our ability for innovation, we are not going to be able to do any of that. I already am talking to people who are worried that they're going to have to leave the country to get their healthcare elsewhere because they're worried that they're not going to be able to get the most innovative treatments here in this country, because we are seeing exactly what you said, this brain drain. And that is very sad.
The other thing that I think people are not necessarily thinking about is it's one thing to say that we're not going to have new studies, or that studies that have just been started in the last few years are not going to be able to continue. But sometimes the most valuable studies are the ones that have been going on for the longest time, because one of the limitations of science, and particularly in medicine, is what we call a prospective longitudinal study, meaning it's one thing to give someone a drug and see what happens with it 2 years later, 3 years, 4 years, but what we want to know is what happens 20 or 30 years later. And as an example, we've talked so often about the Women's Health Initiative, the WHI. And yes, we got a tremendous amount of information in the first 5 years to 10 years after that study was initiated, but we're still generating data. And this data is critically important to know what happens to women who've been taking hormone therapy for 20, 25, 30 years. What happens if they've not been taking hormone therapy? And the WHI was defunded completely. And this is one of the rare instances, and I don't know how it happened. I'm not asking any questions, but someone actually stepped in and said, whoa, this should not be defunded. This is really important. And they got the funding back. And I will also just mention that the funding for the WHI in the world of funding was quite minimal to keep it going. We're talking $10 million a year, which is less than someone spends a weekend playing golf, I'm just saying, that we are paying for. But all right, I promise not to get too political. We're just going to stick to the science.
Well, and I think the point that you brought up earlier, you asked me if microplastics cause cancer, and I made exactly that point. Microplastics haven't been around for, you know, 1,000 years or 100 years even. We need to do the science and the data and look at these longitudinal trials. You can't just create data in a week, a month, a year. Some of these trials and some of these studies are ongoing for sometimes decades in order to see the long-term impact. And that goes in line. The words that they're saying are correct. We need to make our country healthy. We need to think, how are we going to do these interventions? But we can't just wave a magic wand and say, we're going to make everyone healthy. We have to use the data and the science, and it requires years and years of dedicated scientific inquiry and evidence and trials and all of the things we're talking about. And how horrible is it if you have something that you've been studying for 30 years and you need another 10 years to understand really the impact, and it gets shut down 10 years early? So the last 30 years of data, you now have 10 more years that you're not going to collect. It's just, it's really unfortunate that we're seeing this happen currently in our country.
Well, I would like to personally nominate you for Surgeon General.
I accept.
Thank God. I'm so happy. And then if you want to be the Queen of England, I'll make you the Queen of England.
Too. Thank you. Love it.
Yeah, you do get to go to a lot of great parties and all. So there's
that. That's what I hear.
This has been great. Is there anything you want to add? I'm sure there is, but okay. Last thoughts.
I think my last thought is there's a lot of information out there now with the internet, with social media. There's a lot of people out there claiming to be experts. And one thing I tell my patients, I tell my friends, I tell my colleagues, when you are finding information online, vet your sources and find multiple sources, because a lot of people out there are claiming to be experts and they have no expertise other than they have, you know, a million followers on TikTok. There are some physicians and some scientists who are out there using social media for good, using it to promote evidence-based, science-based, factual information. But I really encourage you, when you're looking at the online information, please, please, when you're doing your own research, make sure you're vetting the experts that you're listening to. Make sure that you're identifying where they're coming from, what their expertise is, why they're saying what they're saying. Look for the data, follow the information, and don't just blindly believe what someone says because they have a large following on social media.
And to your point, so many people say to me, well, okay, how do I do my research? Where do I go? What resources do I use? And it really is about finding the experts. And I did an episode sometime back, I'll put it in the program notes, about how do you know an expert's an expert. And there's some very specific things you can look at. Do they have an academic appointment at a university? Have they published in scientific journals on this topic? Are they asked to speak at medical conferences? All of those things are very good indications of, is that person data-driven? Are they science-driven? And can you trust what they tell you? And then again, to make sure that they're not selling anything.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you.
Well, thank you so much. This was very informative and fun for me.
Me too.
And thank you so much. And I look forward to being in the room with you again. I think, I don't know if we have a panel coming up. If not, I hope so. That's the beauty of being in Chicago, that we get to be on panels together. Great fun.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. And thanks for all the work you do in this space. You are a misinformation buster, and I love it.
Well, I could say the same to you. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for joining me. And if you're looking for more inside information, check out my Substack. Just go to drstriker.substack.com. And you can also follow me on Instagram @drstrike.